It's Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. There are 19.8 million acres of public land here in Washington. That's larger than nearly 10 U.S. states. And that's just the land owned by the state and federal governments. Public lands feel like a given for a lot of us. Here in Washington state, we're lucky to have 3 national parks to visit, scores of state parks, and plenty of room to recreate. The great outdoors is ingrained in our state identity. But how we got to this point wasn't always easy. Public land, meaning the idea of land belonging to the people, for the people, has a fraught history. To learn more, I spoke with John Leshy, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of California, Hastings, about his new book, Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands. And we started by talking about how public lands played a role in uniting the United States.
The public lands, they have been a force in American society since the very beginning. In fact, my book opens with a story about how during the Revolutionary War, the 13 colonies had a great deal of trouble getting together and forming a national government, in part because half of the colonies had claims to Western lands, lands across the Appalachians, and the other half of the colonies did not. And so there was a bitter division between the two that prevented the government from actually being formed. The deal that was cut was ultimately that the colonies with the Western land claims would give them to the national government. And so that was really the beginning of the federal public lands. Those were the first public lands, and they were created to basically heal a division that allowed the nation to be formed.
Of course, we can't talk about the history of land here without addressing the genocide and displacement of Native people from their ancestral homes. And I'll get to some modern-day issues related to Indigenous rights and legal movements to include Native people in decision-making about public lands in just a minute. Now, fast forward more than 100 years, and author John Leshy explains how a series of presidents brought public lands to Washington state, including some intense wheeling and dealing with railroad companies over lucrative timber deals.
The National Forest System came about because of a law Congress passed in 1891, which authorized the president of the United States to set aside areas for forest reserves. And so succeeding presidents over the next 20 years, Republican and Democrat alike, basically used that law to create the National Forest System. Grover Cleveland in 1897 created the first national forest in Washington, a couple of million acres of forest reserves. That in Washington was pretty controversial because of the timber impacts and the concern about logging, both pro and con. If you look at history, which my book spends a good deal of time looking at, the creation of the forest system, in almost every case, these forest reserves were created because the locals wanted them. They petitioned the national government. They petitioned the president. We want to safeguard those mountain water supplies. And so that was really a big driver in the national forest system. Now, in most parts of the West, that wasn't particularly controversial. In the state of Washington, particularly in Western Washington, it was controversial because there were big, frankly, corporate interests, logging interests, and railroad interests that wanted to exploit those lands. And so in Washington, much more than in any other state, there was controversy at the ground level about creating forest reserves, and particularly in the West, in the western part of the state, that is in the Olympic Peninsula in particular. For example, Grover Cleveland set aside lands on the Olympic Peninsula. President McKinley came along a few years later and reduced, didn't eliminate, but reduced the size of the forest reserves. And then Theodore Roosevelt came along a few years later and enlarged the forest reserve again, and then made a national monument on the Olympic Peninsula. And then Franklin Roosevelt came along 30 years later and helped work with Congress and the local members of Congress to create a national park on the Olympic Peninsula. So what happened there was in some ways typical, but in some ways atypical because of the rich forest reserve, the logging potential.
I just want to jump in to talk about the Mount Olympus National Monument, which you just referenced, that Teddy Roosevelt established in 1909 in Washington state. Why is it that he comes in and instead of making a national park at that point, President Roosevelt decides to go and establish the National Monument? Can you talk about how that proceeded?
By custom, only Congress creates national parks. You cannot put, the presidents don't have the power to put a park label on federal lands. Only Congress can use that label. presidents can do much the same thing by using the Antiquities Act, and they can do that with a stroke of a pen. They don't need Congress because Congress has already given them that authority in the Antiquities Act. So Roosevelt came along in 1909, and he was a pretty impatient guy, and he said, I don't want to wait for Congress to get around to making a park here. I'm going to make a national monument using my power under the Antiquities Act. And so that's what he did. 25 years later, Congress comes along with the support of President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and makes the core of it a national park.
A lot of our most famous public lands, as you established here in Washington, originated as forest reserves. Mount Rainier National Park, for example, was a reserve before it was declared a national park. What did Mount Rainier gain when it moves from being a forest reserve to a national park? And why is that moment significant in U.S. history?
Well, it's a very interesting story because Rainier is actually wasn't the first national park. Yellowstone was the first in 1872. Rainier comes along in 1899, and it was a kind of transitional park, you could say, because it definitely had some flaws. I mean, if you look at the original legislation that Congress enacted creating Mount Rainier National Park, it allowed railroad building, logging, mining, all kinds of things inside a park that would never be tolerated today. That was opposed by many people, including people around Seattle that didn't want, you know, railroads and logging and stuff in the parks. And eventually those exceptions were eliminated. So it became a kind of a full-fledged national park within a few years. But at the beginning, the kind of political compromise that was necessary to get the park legislation out of Congress was that the railroads wanted their bite of the apple and the logging companies wanted their bite of the apple. And they got some sweetheart deals out of it, as I explained in the book, because ultimately they got a right to exchange claims they had inside that park for rich timberlands elsewhere, including in Oregon. So they traded a fair amount of land to the federal government in Washington and got some rich timberland in Oregon out of that deal. Now that's, you know, again, that's the way politics sometimes has to work. So Rainier is a pretty interesting example of a park that was pretty flawed in its creation, but eventually things were worked out that it became a kind of a full-fledged protected large area.
Yeah, mining, timber, it's not things you think about with a national park, certainly. It's a surprising part of the history of public lands that you can read about in John Leschi's new book. He is the author of Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands, and he joins us now on Soundside on KUOW. Now, Olympic National Park is a great example of how public lands are very frequently going to rub up against tribal rights. The Quileute tribe on the Olympic Peninsula is nearly surrounded by the national park there, which has led to several disputes over the last 20 years or so. In 2012, President Obama signed a law transferring 785 acres of Olympic National Forest to the Quileute tribe to allow them to move to higher ground out of a tsunami zone. And they exchanged that for guaranteed beach access for visitors. The Quinault tribe, just a little farther south, also has fought over several decades to get more ancestral lands ceded from public lands. And all in all, there are 8 tribes on the peninsula that have to work with the federal government on their traditional lands. How often over our history would you say that these disputes have concluded with a favorable result for tribal rights?
It's a very important part of the modern story of public lands. And by modern, I would say post-World War II. First of all, when tribes were dispossessed, they rarely relinquished connections to those ancestral lands. After World War II, as modern tribes revived their sovereignty and became more assertive about being heard and respected in this process, they began demanding and winning a greater consideration by federal land managers and the Congress of their interests and traditions and their values. And that was very important beginning after World War II. So what you described happened on the Olympic Peninsula has happened in a number of other places. You could say there are two kinds of ways of dealing with it. One is to, in particular cases of injustice or need, the United States may transfer title. And there are examples of this all over the place. I mean, President Nixon, for example, restored an area called Blue Lake in New Mexico to the Taos Pueblo because it had been wrongfully taken from them and it was a sacred site to them. Nixon had the authority and he sort of gave it back to the Taos Pueblo. That's happened in a few other places. Happened last year in Montana where Congress passed a law that gave something called the National Bison Range, which was a federal wildlife refuge, back to the tribes in northwestern Montana. So sometimes title is transferred. More often, what Congress does is to give the Native nations more power and influence over how particular areas of federal land are managed. The big example here, and the one that perhaps many of your listeners have heard about, is the so-called Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah. This is an area that a number of different tribes had ancestral connections to, and they very smartly actually came together in a coalition, and they petitioned the national government to protect these areas. They're federal lands, but it petitioned them to protect the cultural sites on these areas and to give that coalition of tribes more influence over how those lands are managed and protected. And President Obama used the Antiquities Act to create a national monument on about 1.5 acres in southern Utah, the Bears Ears National Monument, and created in his monument proclamation a commission composed of the Native Nations representatives to advise the government on how that land will be managed.
There's been a lot of enthusiasm for the appointment of Deb Haaland, a member of the Laguna Pueblo, as Secretary of the Interior in the Biden administration. And Secretary Haaland recently appointed Charles Sams III from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation as Director of the National Park Service. And they're both the first Native Americans to hold their positions. How do you see their appointments impacting the relationship between our public lands and Native nations?
I think they're both appointments are tremendously significant. Since World War II, there has been an expansion of, an appropriate expansion of Native nations' influence over federal lands and how they're managed and the makeup of federal lands. And these two appointments really do both signal that was a very positive evolution and will continue and probably expand. You know, like many aspects of society, the federal agencies that manage lands haven't always historically appreciated and respected the Native nations' influence over these lands and their history. And so I'm hopeful that confident actually that these appointments, and particularly Secretary Haaland, who's the first Native American ever to serve in the cabinet, and it, of course it's terrifically important and appropriate that she's the Secretary of the Interior, because the Interior Department manages most of the federal lands, not all of them, but most of the federal lands. So I think we'll see more use of public lands to correct historical injustices and address these important cultural and resource protection issues. And that's a good thing.
John Leshy is author of the new book, Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands. You're listening to Soundside on KUOW. If we think about national parks and national ownership, it's really designed to allow people to view and witness the grandeur of these places, make them accessible to the public. But here in Washington, for example, Mount Rainier National Park and Olympic National Park are two of the top 15 or so most visited parks in the country, and that brings its own set of headaches for the state and for the federal government. In non-COVID times, Olympic sees over 3 million visitors a year, Rainier about 1.5 million people a year. And for some parks, officials are saying that such high visitorship is really killing them. Folks up in Leavenworth on a recent trip that we took as a show, they recently told us that the Wenatchee River and trails in the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest, they're just being trashed because of increased use. How does the government balance public access to these beautiful lands with conservation? Because it seems like we really can love our public lands to death.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's one of the tremendous challenges that the federal lands face. The other two obviously are climate change and the sort of loss of biodiversity, which are both worldwide problems. But in the United States, it has been an explosion in a sense. If you look at the statistics, I mean, they have spiked upward so sharply. Just last year, Yellowstone, a million people swarmed into Yellowstone in 1 month. It had never happened before. All of the public lands, or many of the public lands, particularly the really iconic sites, you know, the sites that people really know well, are being overrun. And it's a huge management problem. How do you deal with it? Well, you have to educate people, obviously. A lot of people who are out there now are kind of first time encountering public lands. And, you know, many people kind of don't know how to behave in those situations. And you really need to educate them. So that's part of the problem. To some extent, you may need controls. Nobody likes to talk about that in terms of, you know, quotas and limiting visitation. But it has been done successfully in many specific areas of public lands. One I'm very familiar with is the Grand Canyon, the river trips through the Grand Canyon. Obviously, you can't just let as many people who want to do that. It's risky and everything else, and it's a very fragile kind of ecosystem. So the Park Service for 30 years is actually, 40 years really, has actually limited, carefully controlled the number of people who can raft through the Grand Canyon. And they do it partly through commercial enterprises, and partly they have a lottery system for people who want to go on their own.
We have a similar system with the Enchantment Wilderness Area in Washington State, which is a big ticket for people to actually get drawn in that lottery to be able to take those hikes.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm of two minds on this, because it's really important that people get out to the public lands, and you don't want to do anything to discourage people from visiting the public lands. But at the same time, particularly in fragile sites, you really have to control the number of visitors. Another thing you can do, and this gets back to one of the points I make in my book, is the public lands have lots of places that are really quite special that people don't, not that many people know about. And so you can disperse visitation to some extent and lessen the impacts on some particular site. So I think it'll be a combination of things. Now, one of the challenges of managing this exploding visitation is you have to have people, you have to have park managers, you have to have rangers and that sort of thing. And one of the challenges the public lands face is underfunding. To me, the public lands are a great bargain in terms of what we pay for them. The budgets of these four federal agencies that manage almost all these lands, it's like 1/3 of 1% of the total federal budget. So it's really, we manage these lands on the cheap, and we need to spend more money. We need to put more money into these agencies. And the total personnel in these agencies is only about 3% of the total civilian federal workforce. So we really need to do some more in that area. And when you add the explosion of visitation on top of climate change and the biodiversity protection issues, there's some big challenges that the federal lands are facing.
Well, the title of your book is Common Ground, and you're saying that public lands are a uniting force in this country, that regardless of political affiliation, we can all look at the natural beauty of our country and find, well, common ground there. But here in the Northwest, of course, we think about, for example, the Bundys down in Oregon taking over part of a wildlife refuge in a fight over what they saw as government tyranny over land that should be used as people see fit. Their idea is that by keeping the public from using that land, in this case for free grazing rights, that was government overreach. So is it fair for me to be feeling a little skeptical about your thesis that public lands are overall a political uniting force?
Well, several things. One is, you know, obviously Americans have always had strong disagreements about the role that the national government should play in all kinds of issues. So there'll always be opponents of federal lands. I do not claim that the federal lands don't have opponents or people who want them privatized. But my basic point is that the people who believe that are a small minority and always have been. The overwhelming majority don't want that. And the small minority often have their facts totally wrong. And the Bundy, Oregon wildlife refuge takeover is a classic example. I mean, their argument was a fantasy. We want the lands back, they said. The United States paid money, cash, for title to those lands in that refuge from a willing seller corporation that was failing in the 1930s, who owned the land privately and couldn't make a go of it and wanted to be rescued by the national government. So the national government came in and bought those lands in the 1930s. So for the Bundys to say we want the land back was a ridiculous argument. And by the way, the Paiute Indians that had the ancestral claims there certainly laughed at that one, that the we want the lands back kind of thing. I think, and I try to make the case in the book, that the moves to acquire, hold, and protect these lands always had tremendous popular support and do today. And there's no doubt about that. If your listeners want to do something interesting, go to the Colorado College website. They do a poll every year of all of the Western states' populations, Republicans and Democrats. It's a totally nonpartisan poll on public land issues. And do you want public lands protected, et cetera, et cetera? Overwhelming majorities across the board, Republicans, Democrats in all the Western states for decades have supported the public land. So I think the polling data is absolutely clear on this. It's a political success story. In other words, the idea that we have and hold tremendous amounts of land and national ownership for primarily for conservation and recreation is something that the people overwhelmingly want. And it's a way, it's a success story of our political system. Now, I'm the last to say that many people today, unfortunately, for one reason or another, are polarized and they don't think the government ever does anything any good. What I'm saying is step back, look at the history of public lands, and you will see this is something that the government has produced something that people want and cherish today. And so we should learn from that. Because we're going to need that kind of understanding and respect for government and the political process if we are to do things like solve the problem of climate change and biodiversity protection and that sort of thing. Because the whole way we solve those problems is to put aside our narrower interests and look for the common interest. And that's what the public lands, I think, have represented in the history of America.
That was John Leschi talking about his new book, Our Common Ground, A History of America's Public Lands. And that's it for Soundside today. Our show was produced by Noel Gasca and Alec Cowan, with support from Sarah Leibovitz and Brandy Fullwood. I'm Libby Denkman. We're back tomorrow with more Soundside.